First case on our calendar is 040809, testimony of counsel versus Deborah O'Neill. Justice Stratton has recused herself in this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Stratton, Judge Ralph Winkler, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the First Appellate District. Justice O'Connor is obviously not here. She's had a death in her family, but she will be participating in all of the matters that we hear today. Mr. Greer.
May it please the court, I'm David Greer from Dayton, and I have the honor and responsibility of representing Judge O'Neill in this matter before you. With me at council table is my associate Gretchen Statt and Judge O'Neill. Consider the position of a trial judge called upon to render sentence on a defendant who has been found guilty of assault. The operative facts of the assault are that it was a sexual assault, and for the details of it, you can look at Exhibit 2 in this case. One of the grievances that's a subject of this is the Birchler grievance, and at pages 6 and 7 is the transcript of the prosecutor's statement of the operative facts on which Mr. Birchler was convicted of assault. Those facts are, I don't have to repeat them here, they're clear in the exhibit. It is a very sexual assault. A judge faced with the job of sentencing Mr. Birchler after his plea of guilty to those operative facts could have put him into incarceration for 6 months, and that would be the end of it, and we wouldn't be here today. The judge could, like Judge O'Neill, consider the rehabilitative aspects of the criminal law system and impose probation on him. She gave him 60 days of work release and then placed him on probation. One of the conditions of probation was sex offender counseling, which, if you read the operative facts, was certainly an appropriate condition of his probation. He did not abide by the terms and conditions of his probation. There was a revocation, there was an appeal. The Court of Appeals found that he had not been given notice that in the sex offender treatment that he would receive, he might have to admit that he had committed an offense. The matter then came back. The man now had notice, and he was given the option and opportunity of withdrawing his plea or doing what would have been the rehabilitative goal that the criminal law sought to achieve. That, in a nutshell, is the Birchler case. It was the first case presented in this 19 days of hearings. It is the first case discussed in the brief of disciplinary counsel. He devotes more than three times as much space to that case as to any other. He calls it one of the most serious episodes of misconduct that's before this court. He charges Judge O'Neill with demonstrating bias when she, quote, erroneously stated that Mr. Birchler had committed a sexual assault. Read pages 6 and 7 of the operative facts on which that man was convicted. That, if we don't have time in 15 minutes to go through all of these
Well, counsel, you don't, and let me take you to the panel dissent. Judge Puffenberger, and I'm not sure I pronounced his name correctly, wrote an impassioned dissent in which he concluded that there were many incidents, but none of them rose the level of discipline except he concluded that the respondent was lacking on some occasions in appropriate judicial temperament. Could you address that?
I certainly could, and certainly Judge Puffenberger's dissent is, I think, hits the nail on the head. The only issue in this case is an issue of judicial temperament. The other, as Judge Puffenberger points out, and as indeed Judge Kane, one of the grievant judges, conceded, you take any one of these incidents, and it's not particularly problematic taken singly. And I would submit that the sum is not greater than the whole of the parts, so that we're left with the only real issue in this case, one of judicial temperament. And an issue of there were instances where Judge O'Neill was abrupt or sharp with people, or where she raised her voice. But that's about all that the real judicial temperament issues in this case amount to.
How would you describe her temperament?
I would describe, if she were a man, I would describe her as a tough, no-nonsense judge. And I think she deserves the same description as a woman. There have been occasions, and I think you'll see in the transcript of these lengthy things, that where she has overreacted to someone, it is when somebody has challenged her authority, said, I'm not going to go to trial in your court, or I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to do that. So she has, there have been times when she has indeed overreacted to challenges
now,
by attorneys.
Overreactions and her lack of judicial temperament, is this a daily, does it occur on a daily basis, or is it rare? How would you describe that?
Well, absolutely not. She's been a judge for 12 years. If you take 5 days a week as judicial time, that's over 3,000 days. We've got a number of instances here where she has lost her temper. She's had interpersonal problems with other judges or with personnel at the court. There were some 33 witnesses that testified on her behalf, in addition to the 66 witnesses that appeared on the other side of this case. And the record is replete with statements as to her professional attitude, her skills at case management, her handling of trials. It's fascinating to me that among all of the grievances presented here, there is not a single claim that in a trial involving a contest between two litigants, either on the civil side or criminal side, in an actual trial, she has demonstrated any bias. She has not provided an absolutely fair trial to anyone who has gone through trial.
Well, there is a conclusion, is there not, by the board, that she threatened to terminate someone's bond or bail if they went to trial? Does that not prejudice the rights of parties in the court?
There are four such grievances presented here, two of alleged threats to revoke bond, two issues where bond was revoked. If you look at those specific instances, A, no one was denied the right to go to trial. If they wanted to go to trial, they had a perfect right to go to trial, just like everybody else in her court.
Because they pleaded, wasn't that what happened? They decided that they're going to lose their bond or go to trial, so they plead. She forced them to plead. That's the conclusion of the board.
That conclusion is not supported by the evidence in this case, Justice Moyer. I think that if you look at those four cases, three out of the four were cases where any judge hearing that case would understand that there was a risk that if this individual stays outside the courthouse, there is a serious risk of intimidation of witnesses. In the Cox case, the woman came to court and it was made known that she was charged with assaulting her daughter, domestic violence on her daughter. It had happened before, she'd been convicted of it before, and she had been putting pressure on her daughter not to testify. In the Montoya case, the crimes with which the man were charged were crimes of intimidating witnesses and trying to keep them from testifying. In the Werner case,
But that wasn't the reason she gave for saying she was going to withdraw the bond, was it? I don't recall that there was any finding. I may be wrong, but I don't recall that the board found that she gave as a reason that the person was some danger to the community if there was no bond. The statements are, if you're going to go to trial, no more bond. Now that's in the record, isn't it?
It's not in the record in that sense. I think you have to look at.
Well, I'm paraphrasing, but that seems to be the gist of one of the findings.
I think what you need to do is look objectively at the circumstances of each of those four cases, two of which did involve bond revocations. And I think you will find that all of those people were indeed flight risks. They were expressing agitation, disruption in the court. And all of them had the option of going to trial if they so chose. I think another thing that is...
Of the 70, I think I read, it got down to 76 people that appeared and testified for the disciplinary counsel. Of the 76, other than the colleague judges who testified, did anybody file a complaint or a grievance of these 76? Over the matter that affected them?
Absolutely not. The only grievances that were filed by the her peers on the court.
Okay, and with respect to her colleagues on the court, I saw that Judge Watson indicated one time he went in and as the administrative judge had a little, I'll describe a prayer meeting, and she said it wasn't that long, so there was a dispute as to what took place in that conversation. Other than that, was there any effort by her colleagues to sit down with her and say, look, we have some issues with the way you're handling certain, I think these are all pretty much either criminal matters or staff matters, the way you're handling some of the courthouse staff and the way you've handled some of these issues on criminal cases. And we need to correct that or we're going to take this to disciplinary counsel. Was she given any, was there any effort to mediate this or without first filing a formal complaint?
No, there was not, Your Honor, and I think the record shows that for years what happened was like a high school class where you've got the outsider who is ostracized by her peers. That's what happened here. And this court has shown leadership in trying to promote collegiality and professionalism among the bar, and it seems to me to stretch the disciplinary rules without precedent into the area we have here undercuts that whole laudable goal.
Mr. Greer, on the issue of judicial temperament, I'll give you some extra time. We've suspended lawyers who have engaged in conduct that was far less severe than if the board is correct in its conclusions and the persons who testified against her, including a whole range of people. I mean, lawyers and her staff, the sheriff's department, sheriff's office. We've suspended lawyers who have acted in many and in one or two instances in a courtroom in which their conduct was inappropriate in the temperament. There, should a judge be held to any higher standard, or should we treat a judge differently in that respect? Here we have repeated again. If we believe what the board's findings are and the record, there are repeated instances of her temperament getting in the way of both her relations with her colleagues, with her employees not wanting to work for her, with lawyers who don't want to practice before her, don't want to take clients before her. Is there a different standard for a judge in temperament than there is for a lawyer?
There may well be a different standard because lawyers appearing before a judge are subject to the contempt power of the court. And indeed, in many of these instances where there are issues of intemperance in the course of proceedings with lawyers, those lawyers were indeed being intemperate with the judge. I think all these things, if you put them in context, are not issues that rise to the level of disciplinary issues.
I'm going to ask both sides this question. In Ohio, we have the elective process of judges, and the citizens are given an opportunity to either elect or not elect a judge. Certainly, temperament is an important factor. Does that make a difference? Because I think Judge O'Neill just recently went through an election, and there has been in the past a numerous articles concerning Judge O'Neill. So we can hardly say that the public did not know what was going on, and yet she was reelected. So does that make a difference? And especially in light of the Chief Justice's recent question, does that make a difference between judges and lawyers?
I think that it does. That's the public's right, and indeed one of the disturbing things about the grievances in this case is that both Judge Miller and Judge Kane have acknowledged that they began in a reaction to her reelection back in her second term, for her second term. And as soon as that happened, they sat down and said, well, they voted her back in, now we've got to figure out a way to get her out. That's not the way the process is supposed to work in a democratic society.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Greer. Mr. Coghlan.
May it please the court. I'm John Coghlan, disciplinary counsel relator in this matter. The evidence in this case calls for disbarment. There is an extensive nature of misconduct that Judge O'Neill engaged in. There is the serious nature of the misconduct that Judge O'Neill engaged in. There are 10 separate incidents of violations of DR 1102A4, making misrepresentations that the board found. We have the 8 aggravating factors: pattern of misconduct, multiple offenses, submission of false statements during the disciplinary process, refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of her misconduct, the vulnerability and resulting harm to others, selfish motive, complete lack of remorse for her conduct, and the continued assertion that she is the victim of a conspiracy. Count one, focus on 10 cases.
Well, let's deal with that. Whatever you call it, wouldn't you say it's a bit unusual for your colleague judges to have a conference or to tell your own staff people, or whether there's, I don't know what you call your bailiff and your court reporter, whether they're your staff or not, to tell them to go back and take notes and report back on what you see, anything bad that you see happening. And in one case, I think it was the court reporter's keeping a diary.
No one told that court reporter to do that, Your Honor. That's absolutely not in the record in this case. That reporter decided on her own to keep that record, that diary. And in fact, when it was requested of her.
But I mean, if that's going on, I mean, when these charges get laid down and you're looking at it, wouldn't you begin to think they're all against me? I mean, whether they are or not, can't you understand that a judge in that situation might reasonably conclude that?
I can't imagine what Judge O'Neill was thinking at the time. I do know that I would have reached out to my colleagues to find out what was going on and what the problems were. What we have in this case is that every effort
made. Well, and what about the reverse of that? Why wouldn't the colleagues reach out to her and say, look, Judge O'Neill, we're hearing these complaints from people who work for you or appear in your courtroom. I mean, I assume they hear them from every courtroom from time to time, but the degree of them seemed to be worse. So why wouldn't, before you undertake the effort to bring formal disciplinary charges, why wouldn't colleague judges say, look, there seems to be some problems here?
I think that happened.
And if you don't undertake some effort to resolve them in some way and get control of your temper when you lose your temper.
I think those approaches were made.
Judge Watson testified that he did that. But
before that, Judge,
all right.
In June of 2000, there was a personnel committee meeting of the judges. Judge O'Neill had just had her, July of 2000. She just had her court reporter taken from her for her abusive treatment of her court reporter. Both float bailiffs were removed from her courtroom. She was now in a situation with a very dire staff problem. She came to that personnel committee meeting. They discussed the problem with her. They agreed, and she agreed, oh, well, I'm having these issues. I will try to do better. They gave her a new court reporter, which was Sherry Nice. That didn't stop any of the problems from that point forward. Then the next January is when Judge Watson went to see her. He sat down with her and went over these very issues in the exact attempt to do what you've described. She, in this hearing, she denies that conversation. The significant parts of that conversation, that did not happen. Yet Judge Watson reduced it to a memo that very same day. That's what we're dealing with, someone who does not acknowledge her own involvement in her misconduct.
So we should disbar her.
That is our position.
That seems extreme.
It's extreme because her behavior is extreme. Her misconduct is extreme.
Are there any reported cases that you can cite to us for temperament violations which have resulted in disbarment of a judge?
No, I can't. The vast majority, in fact, I think every other jurisdiction in the country, when they have a judicial discipline case, what they face as a possible sanction is removal. Ohio is unique in looking at possibly disbarring a judge. So we have a process that other states don't have. So I can't cite a case from another jurisdiction just for this purpose. But the real
question—
But
you're asking us to impose the most severe disciplinary sanction.
I submit with any lawyer stood in front of you who had engaged in 10 separate incidents of lying in court, there would be no question you would actively consider disbarment. If you added to that, the lawyer came into his or her own disciplinary case and lied on the record repeatedly in that disciplinary case about those incidents and others, there would be no question disbarment should occur. Well, and as Chief Justice Moyer mentioned, we have a higher standard for judges.
Yes, but I will ask you that question now. We also have an elective process of judges. So if we were to disbar Judge O'Neill, we would really be nullifying what the citizens chose to do. They chose to reelect Judge O'Neill. And it wasn't that they didn't know anything that was going on about Judge O'Neill. There were many, many stories in the paper prior to her reelection, and yet they reelected her.
Well, they've reelected her once, and they have not elected her to the Court of Appeals since then. But I submit that the electoral process—
Well, that has nothing to do with anything. They reelected her to her own seat.
That's correct.
Perhaps they thought she would, you know, who knows what the reasons for not electing her to the Court of Appeals. That's neither here nor there to my question. The question is, disbarment is nullifying the vote of the citizens.
I agree that that's what it is, but in every instance where this court sanctions a judge, it's in effect taking that action against someone who's an elected official.
We have done that before.
Right, that's happened.
We have disbarred them, but we have certainly found them to be have engaged in conduct for which we've suspended them.
Correct.
Judge Ferrari in Cleveland is a good example.
Correct.
Voters elected him, and we said, your conduct, which the voters didn't know about, your conduct says to us that you have to be suspended for a period of time.
And I would submit
we've
that
done
but
it
we
more
all,
than once.
But I think we've always done it in such a way that it was only for a six-month period so that that judge would not lose their elected position and would be able to be given an opportunity to correct their behavior. You're asking for disbarment, which I think is extremely harsh. That just takes Judge O'Neill off the bench without an opportunity to do anything about her. She admits that she does have problems with her temperament.
We don't know that she would not be able to practice law competently, do we? Her conduct here is all related to her. I know some of it goes over into court of professional responsibility, but if she were not a judge, we don't know that she couldn't practice law competently, do we, from this record?
We're making this recommendation because after careful consideration of the record, we feel that she could not effectively practice law because of her willingness to make misrepresentations on a repeated basis.
Because of the lying is what you're
correct.
Saying.
If she's willing to make journal entries, put information in journal entries that is false, that damage the defendants in front of her, that harm defendants in front of her and do that repeatedly, then as a lawyer, she will stand up in front of a court and we cannot trust that she will do anything different. And why is that? Because she denies she did it here. We have no acknowledgement.
Well, counsel, this is a painfully long case, and the report of the board is, or the panel, it's really the panel report, which the board's got one paragraph in it, is tedious to read. But I don't think it's undisputed. Your characterization of her repeated lies, they're in, every one of those is in some degree of dispute.
That's not true, Your Honor.
Oh, yes, it is. I've read the whole thing. Now, don't dance with me on that. They put every one of them in dispute. You may say the evidence is overwhelming in terms of your point of view, but every issue in here is in dispute. Now, you made a big deal about her testimony didn't conform to her answers, and that was responded to by counsel, indicating that when they had to plead, there hadn't been time and hadn't been the opportunity to go back and go through the records and the transcripts. And then, of course, in some cases, it's conversation. So it's he said, she said kinds of things. But I think they challenged every claim in terms of what you pounce on in terms of saying she's just a liar.
Can I give examples, Your Honor, why?
Yes.
I think this isn't a matter of word against word. That's why this case is so serious, and that's why we're taking the position we take. For example, in Roger Warner, Judge O'Neill revoked his bond after he rejected the plea. That's clear.
Yeah.
In her testimony, she said, well, I didn't reject his plea because, I mean, he rejected the plea, and I wasn't asking that question because I wanted to know if he wanted to accept the plea. I thought he was intoxicated. I was determining whether or not he had the capacity to enter that plea. That was entirely false. If you look at the record that she generated.
Wait a minute. I remember that one. It's not on her own bailiff or somebody else said, I smelled the odor of alcohol on this guy.
Somebody smelled the odor of alcohol.
So we're going to split hairs over what's intoxicated?
No.
I mean, that's what the panel seemed to do. They say, well, yeah, he had the odor of alcohol, but he wasn't intoxicated.
She was testifying that she was asking that question to determine whether or not he had the capacity to enter the plea. That was false. That's what was false. In her own journal entry, she said, defendant rejected the offer. On the record, she says, after he rejects the offer, okay, no further negotiations, no further pleas will be accepted. It was false testimony to the board to say, I was only asking that question to determine if he had the capacity. Her own records call her a liar. That's what we're talking about.
Counsel, I think you use a very pejorative term to apply to situations in which you're splitting hairs about what's going on here.
In Birchler, she says to the defendant, the prosecution's going to withdraw your plea. The law doesn't provide that a prosecutor can withdraw a defendant's plea. She does that to threaten him, to get him to do the counseling that the Court of Appeals has just said he shouldn't have to do because he entered an Alford plea. She threatens him to such extent that he goes and decides, I will go and do the rest of my prison sentence rather than face seeing Judge O'Neill again.
So he spent 6 months in jail for something that the prosecutor charged him with, rape, kidnapping, and the prosecutor's charges would have had him spending a lifetime in jail.
The prosecutor agreed it should be a non-sex offense misdemeanor disposition because they didn't think that any credibility to their
case. If you were the judge and a prosecutor came in with a case that charges rape, kidnapping, and all of that, and then they drop it down to assault, wouldn't you be a little edgy at that point?
If I'm the prosecutor?
No, if you're the judge.
Absolutely, but if I accept that plea, and if I accept it on an Alford basis, that's the conviction the defendant has.
Okay.
That's all that's left of the case. To thereafter assume that he's guilty of rape is inappropriate.
But now he's back, and you know, you're the judge, and you're remembering what happened 6 months ago or whenever it was. You don't have the transcript there. I mean, yes, she was wrong in her recollection of this, but it isn't hard to imagine that you could be wrong about what was transpiring when she's got the defendant back in front of her for the probation violation. Because you're remembering he was charged with rape and kidnapping.
She knows what he pled to. Yeah. She knows what she accepted on an Alford basis. That's all clearly in front of her. And yet, also at that revocation hearing, she goes so far as to hold him in violation, in part, on evidence that he was never noticed about and was never introduced at the revocation hearing, another part of the misconduct. She does what she wants to do in court for her own purposes. That's why we're here, someone who does not abide by the rules.
So Mr. Coghlan, is the rule of law you want us to write that when we can amass a number of isolated instances about a trial court judge over a 5 or 6 year period where a lawyer or a litigant has some disagreement with the court and the court's will pervades, we disbar that judge?
Absolutely not.
I mean, how many instances would it take over 5 years on how many judges to begin a run on getting rid of members of the judiciary that might be really trying to enforce the rules and declare cases frivolous in certain instances or make rulings that might not be popular with certain segments of the litigants or bar?
In relator's view, this case has nothing to do with the situation you've described. We are dealing with a judge who, outside of the proper purposes of making decisions as a judge, rendered decisions that affected defendants. For her own and separate reasons, she did things improperly. She revoked bond to punish a defense lawyer, to revoke bond of one defendant because she's trying to punish the defense lawyer's inability to proceed.
But this
That's
is a dozen or
motive.
So instances over a five-year period. And based on these instances, it's disbarment that you think is the appropriate sanction.
We're dealing with 31 instances over a five-year period. We're dealing with 10 of those instances being active affirmative misrepresentations. We're dealing with affirmative misrepresentations on the record in the disciplinary process. We're dealing with someone who never acknowledges her own responsibility for her misconduct, who cannot change her behavior, and we can never expect her to change her behavior because she doesn't see any role that she played in it.
I disagree with you. Reading her testimony, she said that she wished she had done things a little bit differently. I think she even said, you know, in hindsight, she would have done things differently. So I don't think that she has absolutely said that she would never change her behavior in these situations.
I agree there are two occasions. One occasion she testified she said mistakes were made, things fell through the crack. That's not accepting responsibility. There was another occasion, I think you're referring to, Your Honor, where she does start to take some responsibility. If you follow the rest of that testimony, you see that you get to a point where the panel chair asks her, well, okay, did you lose control in the courtroom? No. Did you ever scream or yell in the courtroom? No. Were you ever discourteous and act improperly in violation of the canon in the courtroom? No. She affirmatively denies that. But that's just as to the temperament. If you look at each of the incidents in count one, she denies the actual substantive misconduct alleged.
Counsel, I read that, and it's an interesting part of this case. That, as Justice Resnick indicated, at some point she indicates, yeah, I should have handled some of these things differently upon reflection. And then in response to those direct questions, she answers no. But then I sat down, and because this case is difficult for me, I suspect for the entire court, I sat down and read through all of the rules. And those questions seemed to be lifted right out of the rules. It was almost like she was being asked to plead violations. when those specific, because they're couched, they almost, those questions that the panel chair asked are couched almost directly out of, if you read the rule, it's like she was being asked, did you violate this rule? Well, she's contesting it, so her answer there would have to be no if that's what she perceived the question to be. Let me ask you, what do you know, because the record doesn't show a lot, about her efforts to seek some counseling? It appears that there's been some of that, probably not nearly enough, because Judge Poffenberger suggests, he suggests that all the judges down there ought to seek some counseling on these kinds of issues, but in particular, the respondent. So what do you know about that? What's in the, what was testified to?
Her testimony was that after these allegations were first brought to her attention and they hit her like a ton of bricks, she had no idea that anybody felt this way, is what she was saying. She sought some counseling. It is my understanding from her testimony that she sought the counseling to deal with the stress of having to deal with a disciplinary investigation, which is understandable. I never heard her testify that she sought counseling to deal with any problems she had with others in the courtroom setting, in anything along those lines. That's my recollection of her testimony. But we don't have anybody standing here in front of you saying, I have a problem, I'll accept help for it. We don't have that. We have someone saying, I don't have any problems. I don't know what their problem is. I didn't do anything wrong.
Counsel, there was some suggestion, I guess by some of her witnesses and also by Judge Poffenberger, that in terms of the courtroom, in terms of dealing with lawyers and litigants, these problems all appeared in criminal cases, and that her handling of civil cases has been seemingly without problem. Is that an overstatement of the case?
There are several civil cases. There are certainly predominance of criminal cases, and I think that's a reflection of her interest keeping her criminal docket down, her obsession with a criminal docket. But there are several civil cases.
And she's voluntarily not running for re-election to the trial court, so
that's correct.
That problem will resolve itself at the end of the year.
Well, she won't be a trial court judge
right.
at the end of the year. What other problems will occur, we don't know. But in a civil case involving Judge Martin as a visiting judge, she castigated him from the bench inappropriately in front of his daughter, in front of a full courtroom of people, because she was angry. She vented her anger completely inappropriately in that case.
Yeah,
that's
and I would agree. That to me was one of the worst examples of intemperance.
I've definitely used my time. Let me just quickly sum up where I am and where a later is in this matter. She's engaged in misrepresentations to litigants and lawyers on the record and in the record. As the board stated, dishonesty and misrepresentations are antithetical to the integrity of the judiciary and prejudicial to the administration of justice. That's a foundation of where we're coming from in this case. The board found these to be the most serious violations. Judge O'Neill also engaged in misrepresentations in her disciplinary hearing. There were 71 witnesses we produced in counts 1 through 5. 38 were lawyers. 5 were judges. She disagreed with every single one of them about significant facts in the case, all in an attempt to exculpate herself from this case. Honesty and trustworthiness are the very foundations of the legal profession. She has demonstrated an inability to abide by those foundational requirements.
You need to sum up, Mr. Colvin.
Thank you, Judge. Justice. She fails to understand her conduct's abusive. She fails to recognize its misconduct at all, and she will continue to make misrepresentations. If that is what we are assured, she will continue to be abusive. For that, she must be removed from our profession. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coglin. Mr. Greer, you've used your time, but you may start with 30 seconds, if you like.
Let me try to say 2 things in 30 seconds.
That's a gift, if you want to take it, you can take it. If not, you don't need to. But.
I understand. Let me start with your comment, which is the comment of the board majority, the two members of the board who were not judges and who had no experience in the criminal law, that both of them said these things do not adversely affect her qualifications to practice law, which is where unless she's fortunate enough to win her election to the Court of Appeals.
I was curious about that, because if they're serious about the number of lies she apparently engaged in, again, if we read the record and read the report, I was kind of curious about that if there's a pattern of lying, I guess it doesn't matter to them if the person's a lawyer, but we've suspended lawyers for one lie, and certainly for a pattern of lying.
The word lie is a pejorative term that I submit to you dissipates right when you study the record in this case. And this case, one thing everyone has agreed on is unique and unprecedented. There is no precedent for it. There are proceedings in this state for removal of judges if that's the way you want to proceed. They didn't proceed that way. And she's been removed as a judge by fact. I submit to you that if you want to impose significant sanctions on Judge O'Neill, I really do think you are opening a Pandora's box for every judge in Ohio. You're defeating the goal of collegial intervention, and you're defeating the elective process.
Throughout all of the, even the report of the commission, they're certainly in your argument and her position seems to be there doesn't seem to be much concern for people who come into the court system or the court, common pleas court here in Franklin County. Our attention is on the respondent, and her colleagues should have helped her and all of that, but what about the people that have been the employees who didn't want to work for her, the one who had psychological counseling or whatever, had to go to a doctor? Should we be in our decision making? Should we be all concerned about the effect of the conclusions? If we accept the conclusions of the board, should we be at all concerned about the impact on people that have been affected by this conduct?
Let's take two classes of people. One, the court personnel, and you'll find her present staff and other people on the staff who said she's wonderful to work with. You'll find some that she's had friction with, and with those you'll find that they gave as good as they got. The other class of people coming into the courthouse are defendants and parties to litigation. And if you want to review her sentencing and her individualization of sentences, you will find that she has treated every one of those people fairly. And I think you'll also find that among all the judges in Franklin County, she has done the best job of following the mandates of this court as far as case management and speedy trials are concerned. She has got a good many positive qualities that she exemplified as a judge, along with some negative qualities that she has tried to improve. As far as collegial intervention, those judges' meetings before the grievances were filed were simply Judge Miller calling her a liar without a basis for calling her a liar.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Mr. Coghlan, you think you didn't save any time. I think you want rebuttal. You filed objections as well. So. 30 seconds.
I think that this case is truly unique. I think this court is faced with a situation that all of us hope will never be repeated. But I think a careful examination of the record leads to but one conclusion. Judge O'Neill does not belong in the bench and does not belong in the practice. She has demonstrated that repeatedly by her willingness to engage in misrepresentations, her disregard of others, her willingness to lie about court staff, as the chief mentioned, that the records were pleaded. I didn't even get to talk about that. Numerous staff who had medical problems from trying to deal with the stress of working in her courtroom. That alone is a very serious issue. And Judge Connor, who was not one of the grievance judges, said, she would tell you one story and the staff would tell you another. Which is exactly what the panel in this case experienced. And finally, Judge Watson said, I've never met anybody like her. She's the most effective prevaricator I've ever seen.
I wondered about that term. What does that mean?
Someone who avoids the truth, evades
effective,
telling the truth.
Effective prevaricator.
Right.
Effective. Doesn't that mean that it's hard to tell for sure?
Because she's so good at dissembling.
I mean, if you're not an effective prevaricator, everybody can tell.
Correct. She's very good. What she does, part of what O'Neill's pattern is, not only to make denials, but to go so far as to make false counter-accusations. In the meeting with Judge Watson, she not only said those things were not said to me, she said, he asked me, he told me to fire my bailiff. He told me to fire my bailiff because my bailiff had filed a grievance against Judge Kane. That was entirely wrong, but it sounds good. That's why she's an effective prevaricator, because she's so good at crafting her answer.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.